You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
In the future, we do not want to remain a junior partner, a small opposition party in Parliament. We want to achieve majorities.
And the Alternative for Deutschland party want to achieve them by banning minarets, calls to prayer and full-face veils. Can minority baiting really win you majorities in 21st century Germany? My guests Robert Fox and Michael Goldfarb will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the unlikely alliance that Islamic State's Egyptian affiliate has stirred up against itself, the ongoing anti-Semitism row besetting the UK Labour Party as another three councillors are suspended today alone.
So are you sorry for mentioning Hitler?
I wish I hadn't.
Just say it.
Because it's... You wish you hadn't. And are you sorry for it?
But I'm sorry. I apologise for telling the truth.
But are you sorry that you mentioned Hitler?
Are you sorry you mentioned Hitler?
I regret doing that.
Are you sorry you mentioned Hitler?
Because sorry sounds like I'm apologising for what I said.
No, you're not, Ken.
And on and on and on it has gone. And President Barack Obama's final speech to the White House correspondents. How funny should a political leader be? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Goldfarb, reporter, author and broadcaster, currently writing for politico.eu, and Robert Fox, defence editor of the London Evening Standard. Welcome both back to the show. We will start tonight with something of a curio. It's a semi-heartwarming story from the Middle East of age-old enemies coming together as friends, or at least as people who can't stand each other, deciding that there's someone they can all stand even less. The unlikely alliance of Egypt, Israel and Hamas is now sort of cooperating, or at least not cooperating, against Islamic State's franchise in the Sinai. Robert, first of all, from a military perspective, Hamas has been reported to have sent fighters to Gaza's border with Egypt as part of a deal with Egypt to keep Islamic State out of Gaza. In basic traditional military terms, thinking of Hamas as an army, how serious an outfit are they? Do we know?
I'd be interested to hear what Michael's got to say about this. I think that they could be quite effective for the task in hand, which is that they have got to stop penetration. I think that actually the coverage that I've been reading in the background to this story has been rather slanted towards ISIL, that this is an enormously powerful, overwhelming, overweening bogeyman, which has been part of the Western narrative. It's much more complex than that. Extremely capable that they are in some areas. They're doing poorly in others, ISIL, because there is an ethnic element in this going on. In Sinai is one of the 11 wilayat governorates of the new ISIL extended realm of the caliphate declared by al-Baghdadi himself. But who is in the middle of it? It's very, very interesting that they appear to be causing a lot of trouble in Sinai, which is open space, and they are being pushed back in two areas, which is very, very strange in some ways. In the Syria-Iraq heartland, we know how that one is going, where they're not doing as well as they were doing a year ago. But the most extraordinary story is the Libya story. I don't want to get sidetracked with that, but let's see that this is not what the Italians would call, you know, the grande vecchio, the old man, the conspiracy that is going to engulf us all. It is a game of many, many parts. They're doing badly in Libya. Let's cut to that. And I think there is a narrative going on between the parties that you've described, Israel Security Services. I do think Hamas are capable in defending their own heartland, and they want to defend the southern Gaza border and Egypt, and they do have a common interest. But there is a very powerful contradiction because of Hamas's connection with the Muslim Brotherhood, and we know that Egypt more or less wants to exterminate the Muslim Brotherhood, politically speaking. Anyway.
The interesting thing, first of all, is that it's not the first time that Israel and or that Egypt
and Israel have cooperated because they've cooperated against Hamas in crushing the tunnels, and Hamas and Hamas fighters were killed fighting the Egyptian security services and army. It's not clear, I think, how many of these ISIS pledged fighters there are. Robert described open country. I mean, it's open scrub desert. I mean, there's nothing there. So where they hide is to me of interest, that they couldn't scour them out.
Well, that's why we haven't seen them establishing controlled territory in the way they have in Iraq and Syria.
Even in Libya.
Yeah, there's little in the way of shelter or infrastructure.
What they can do is that they can continually harass. It's on the Sinai side, so they can continually harass the Egyptian army. And I think that Egypt is helping. Israel is helping out. I also note, and maybe Robert knows the timeline here, but after the Muslim Brotherhood government was overthrown by Sisi and this new military, I suppose we have to call it a dictatorship because there's no other way to describe it, took power, it seems to me it was only after that that there began to be really intense attacks from from radical Islamic groups in Sinai. And I just wonder how many of these fighters might be supporters of the brothers who simply decided you can't go underground in the desert, but to go to the desert and carry the fight to Egypt there.
I do think that's a very important point, because the brothers, the evolution, as we know, it's gone through many forms since it was founded, the Brotherhood, by Hassan al-Banna and others in the late 1920s. They are going through a very, very tough stage. There's a very interesting piece I was alerted to and have been reading this morning by an old friend and colleague, David Hurst, formerly of the Guardian, one of the great Middle East commentators, an Arabist to his fingertips. And he was saying how there is now sort of some sort of arrangement, I won't call it collusion, that would be the wrong word, between the regime in Jordan and the Sisi regime to push out the Brotherhood from Jordan. The Brotherhood, which has many, many forms and facets, very different in Syria than it is from Egypt, for example. But part of the narrative now is that they're not quasi-terrorists, but they're terrorist fellow travellers, and they're under pressure. And I think the youthful element that would have supported the Brotherhood, as Michael was saying, in the Arab Spring on the back of Tahrir Square, probably would go over the edge into militancy as well.
I
it's bandit
that's a real
country.
Possibility.
It's real banditism that's going on in Sinai.
Okay, well, let's move on now and take a look at Germany. Now, when Chancellor Angela Merkel generously and gamely proposed to welcome hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees last summer, the most immediate beneficiaries were obviously the migrants and refugees. It was, however, depressingly inevitable that it would be almost as great a boon for Germany's populist far right. And so it proved. The Alternative for Deutschland party did well in state elections in March by beating up on Islam. Emboldened, they've now gone further. Their party conference has adopted a ban on minarets, calls to prayer, and full face veils. Michael, it would be pleasant to think, I think, that there is an upper limit on how far you can get with this kind of rhetoric in 21st century Europe. Is there?
No. Frankly, no. And the thing is that whataboutery is the curse of our times. You think you've got
it's
a clear line
of
argument,
of our times.
And then you think, but I can give you an example from here. So if you say banning the veil, for example, well, I mean, successive French governments have tried to ban the veil in France, and we're not talking about the National Front. We're talking about the Socialist Party and some Gaullist party or other, whichever one gets elected. The idea of banning minarets, this is just populism. It's an appeal to people who just think there shouldn't be Muslims in. But, what we forget in our reporting is, there's a lot of Muslims from long before this exodus, well established, not just in Germany, but in the Netherlands and wherever, and they're three generations in. And you take a risk as a politician in trying to stir up anger against Muslims as a whole, because most of the people in Europe, in European countries who are Muslims, the exception, I think, probably of France, have been there since the invitation of the Gastarbeiter going back to the 1950s and 60s, same as in this country where that was the first great wave of people to come in from South Asia, from Pakistan and Bangladesh. So, you know, I think that there is a limit, but the thing is, there doesn't seem to be any limit to the reading public and the news-consuming public's willingness to listen to stories about parties led by women like Frauke Petri, I think that's her name, who's head of Alternative for Deutschland, and her ability to rabble-rouse on this issue and on the idea of, oh, now we're going to have to take in a million more from Syria or whatever.
Robert, when a government, an incumbent government, is having to make decisions about immigration, such as the ones, you know, that Angela Merkel was faced with last summer, which was obviously, as is so often the case in politics, a difficult decision in less than ideal circumstances, how much should they be taking into account the benefit it might then have to the unsavoury tendencies of their own country's polity?
That is very much an example of the what-if-ery of politics.
It is.
And I'm not weaseling out of it, because I think the thing that Michael has put his finger on is that social media, the narrative is so approximate to the truth, to the ground truth, to facts on the ground. So it's myth and fact get muddled up. And I was just thinking, as he was narrating very clearly and eloquently, you know, the presence of numbers of people who are quite clearly confessing Muslims in Europe. But how very different the roots are. You have got, as he said, if you look at the subcontinental, that is India, Pakistan, predominantly Bangladesh, to a less extent Sri Lanka, into the UK, and we get it muddled up with Al Qaeda, but sort of nearly 50% of them are Deobandi. You talk about France, but the problem with France is, of course, when you're talking about Algeria, it was never a colony; it was always a département de France. It was part of metropolitan France, and I can go on and go on. I think Merkel was brave, and I think because she wasn't going to pander to populism, I think she must be aware. She must have been aware of the possible backlash. But against this, you have this extraordinary narrative, which seeps through public media, of entitlement, of, you know, of world rights. Everybody has a world right. I have a right to my own faith, to self-determination. And it's not only the UN, it's the Helsinki Final Act. And I think this has become a great mess. And therefore, if you feel, as the world is divided into haves or have-nots, that you are deprived, then, of course, you get the politics of rage and resentment. And this is a thing that colours the nationalist parties from Donald Trump all the way through. Look, I thought you were going to raise the thing that I'm most aware of is Geert Wilders and the Freedom Party in the Netherlands, because my family is half Dutch, my wife is Dutch. It is very interesting how he strikes a chord right across the spectrum in populist politics in the Netherlands. But there's one thing that almost every party now represented in the Dutch parliament, with only one or two exceptions, will have nothing to do with this toxic brand, which makes it very, very difficult indeed. It's an easy flag to raise, particularly, as you know, in view of what you described happening last summer in Germany, and then the Cologne New Year's Day or New Year's Eve activities. But I'm not sure yet whether it is going to turn us into, you know, to put us at the mercy of populist, racist politics as in the 1930s.
Michael, the trouble here is that, as Robert was alluding to there, myths are so much more engaging and entertaining than facts, and they travel faster. This is not a new observation, even before anybody invented social media. Is there a means by which politicians from, one might put it, the more sort of rational centre of the spectrum, can actually tackle this? Do you make some concessions to the sentiment, which is certainly at large among your electorate, or do you try to reason with people and lead them out of it?
Well, it depends on the... first of all, part of this has to do with where you are in your electoral cycle. I mean, I wonder if Merkel had been facing an election right now, just this instant, if in the autumn of this of last year she would have been quite so generous, but she had a couple of years in her term, and I think she probably feels, I mean, if I have the power, I might as well use it for some good. I mean, she seems genuine in that respect. So I don't know. I can say that if you're campaign is being managed by Sir Lynton Crosby, who managed to push the Tories over the finish line a year ago and get them a majority, you will suspend all of your most noble instincts and come down hard on the refugees and play the populist card because you will win votes.
Okay, well, on that happy thought, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Michael Goldfarb and Robert Fox. Coming up next, we'll be looking at the UK, where another political party is also making paranoid hatred of the other something of a motif, though not necessarily intentionally.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or that smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat wiped? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 via our free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back enjoying cultural nourishment in the form of the Monocle Arts Review, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today. Stick on your headphones and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You are welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Robert Fox and Michael Goldfarb. Now, in the last few months, anti-Semitism scandals within the UK's Labour Party have become so regular that they could possibly replace the chimes of Big Ben, which is, of course, due to be silenced next year for repairs. There have been three more just today. I did just check that there hadn't been a fourth while we've been on air, which is some going for what is a bank holiday here in the UK. It is a trio of hard-of-thinking councillors who have been suspended for social media transgressions on this occasion. This follows a week dominated by the endeavours of former London Mayor and still senior Labour panjandrum, though currently suspended, Ken Livingstone, to assert that Adolf actual Hitler was a misunderstood Zionist. Robert, first of all, I don't want to get into any discussion of the historical veracity of Mr. Livingstone's claims because they're insane. But I will ask you that the big question first. Is there a specific problem with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party in the UK and the wider Western left, I guess you would say?
Those are two questions, and I think there are difficulties in both, and they are different. And I would just hazard that they are different for the Labour Party because the Labour Party has a very old, and some would say quite honourable, association with the Israeli Labour Party and the Israeli Labour movement. And people, they have talked about Zionism and the foundation of Zionism. And sorry, I will raise the L word. I wish to goodness Mr. Livingstone really understood what the nature of Zionism and the Zionist movement and Herzl's intention and how it all started out. And I wished he would have acknowledged the great contribution of people like the family, Weizmann. Chaim Weizmann, of course, is very, very important to this and was very much intertwined with the Labour Party.
If we start wishing for things that we wish Mr. Livingstone had said or not said, we might be here a while.
This is the DNA of the Labour Party, and I'm not a very good biologist, as you're about to learn, because I say that it seems to have mutated. Because figures like Harold Wilson, like Nye Bevin, who is more or less a saint in the great, one of the founders of the National Health Service, and his wife, Jenny Lee, were pro the State of Israel. They were supporters of Ben-Gurion, of the party, of the Labour Party of Israel, with which they were affiliated and proud of it. Now we've gone in a completely different direction, and there is something going on within the Labour Party, because part of a narrative there which has seen part of the radicalism of people like Livingstone and Corbyn, to name two very significant figures in this thing, has been pro-Palestinian, and if you are
pro-Palestine and the national homeland of the Palestinians. Therefore, you have to be anti-Zionist. Therefore, you have to be anti-Israel. And this is where the trouble starts, because that has, I can see, and I've denied it in myself in the way that I've tried to look at it dispassionately over the past 49 years in journalism, it does lead to a bleeding anti-Semitism. I am very, very sorry to say, and I think that that's what's happened. So can you see what I'm trying to say about the historic Labour Party? It's been turned on its head.
Well, there are now voices within Israel's Labour Party extraordinarily calling for it to abolish or suspend its ties with the UK Labour Party.
Well, I'm not surprised.
No, nor am I. But Michael, is this something in the context of the UK Labour Party in particular, is it something that is flourishing entirely anew under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, or has it always been there but it now feels emboldened?
It's broken the surface.
I think you asked the initial question is about the wider left, and America doesn't have a left affiliated with any party, but it does have a left, and nothing that Jeremy Corbyn's view, Ken Livingstone's view, that Zionism equals fascism, and is something that I heard as a student, and I won't tell you how old I am, but I'm more of their contemporary than I am yours, Andrew. And look, the very stuff that they say was stuff that I heard as an undergraduate in America in the early 1970s, after the extraordinary victory in 1967 when Israel acquired these territories, and the fact that UN 242 wasn't immediately implemented. It's led to this now almost 50-year-long, whatever metaphor you want to use to describe the situation, whether it's a medical one or a political one, doesn't matter. Okay, so now when Jeremy Corbyn's view is that, and it's ridiculous to bring up the Hitler comparison, but if you say the word fascism, it's very easy to make the next step and go Hitler, because Hitler's the world's most famous fascist. So if you think Zionism is fascism, if you think that Zionism is the only animating idea behind the state of Israel, then very quickly you get to, as Robert was saying, that this kind of bleeding anti-Semitism. Now, if you throw into the mix an emigration of Muslims, and it's happened here, it's also happened in France, where there is an instinctive desire to support your fellow Muslims trapped under oppression. I wish they had, I wish British Muslims were as exercised about what is happening in Syria as they are about what happens in Gaza.
Very selective.
It does bother me. But leaving that aside, what you've got is a situation where in Bradford, for example, this whole story started with Bradford's member of parliament, yeah. Nahas Shah. And we all adored Nahas Shah because she pushed out of office the previous representative, George Galloway. Now, George Galloway set up an Israel-free zone. No Israeli goods came in. A Jewish colleague of mine at politico.eu was assaulted last May covering the election because somebody came up and said, "You're a Jew, aren't you?" And it got to be very, very rugged. Now, that, however, is nothing that I would say bleeds into the entirety of the Labour Party. That is a very particular problem, particularly around Bradford. My guess is some of the councillors you alluded to earlier are from the vicinity. So you've got this kind of narrow, very dark spot. But boy, it exerts a gravitational pull, and when it breaks to the surface, it's ugly and it's extremely deleterious to the wider Labour Party, and especially with an election coming up in 72 hours in London, mm-hmm. where a Muslim man, perfectly decent guy, was poised to win. His victory is now open to question. And, London, which is trademarked as the greatest city in the world, was going to have an assimilated Muslim mayor, and now it may not, because of the idiocy of a of a minority in the Labour Party, which just happens to hold the leadership at the moment.
Final thought from you on this one, Robert, before we move on. And unfortunately, it's a question to which I know there isn't a short answer, but I'm going to ask you for one. You were talking about the way Israel has been regarded and reported upon in your many years in journalism. What is it about this specific country that do you think makes it so difficult for people to criticise it or discuss it without calling for it to be abolished or destroyed?
Well, historiographically speaking, can I say this, as Roy Jenkins would have said of himself to more effect, as a semi-professional historian, which indeed I am, and I was taught at Oxford, curiously, because I was there in the shade of the war, by more Jews than I was Gentiles, right through my history syllabus. And I do think that you have the whole story, the horrible story of the Holocaust, and yes, it does put Israel and its credential historiographically, in the terms of Western civilization, in a completely different place. But one thing I'd like to add very, very quickly, what is going on with Labour? It is not history. It is a fabulous narrative. It is a narrative which is confected more on fable at times than fact.
Okay, well, finally tonight, of the many reasons to wonder how hard it can really be to repeal the 22nd Amendment to the US Constitution, among the least of them is that this past weekend saw President Barack Obama deliver his final speech to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, an annual tradition in which the president is invited to make fun of himself, his opponents, and his audience, and which President Obama in particular has always seemed to enjoy. Here's one highlight.
On the Republican side, things are a little more, how shall we say this? A little more loose. Just look at the confusion over the invitations to tonight's dinner. Guests were asked to check whether they wanted steak or fish, but instead, a whole bunch of you wrote in Paul Ryan. That's not an option, people. You may not like steak or fish, but that's your choice.
Michael, first of all, President Obama is a fabulous public speaker. This is not a controversial statement. He's clearly a very naturally funny man as well. But how important has his ease with humour been to his success? How effective a political tool has it been for him?
Well, it's interesting. Probably it hasn't been as effective for him as you might have hoped. He has this one opportunity every year to do this, and maybe once or twice a year he'll break into a soul tune when he's out. And he's got a pretty good voice too, you know. Look, the White House Correspondents' Dinner is a weird occasion. The New York Times doesn't even send a correspondent because it's mostly about how close the press has come to to being the men they cover. But he has used this quite brilliantly because he can't complain. He can't complain the way a white president could complain about the way the Republicans have disrespected him, have refused to cooperate at the most fundamental level, the level that allows the government of a country that has two major parties to function. Someone's going to have the White House. The other team has to kind of work in a cooperative way. So he uses these occasions to his Vegas routine, and it's very funny. I was struck by how close to the knuckle he cut yesterday because, you know, this is his last speech, and he really gave no quarter. Everyone got a slap down. I mean, this was doing the dozens, which is a game from the African-American culture where you just sit on the front stoop with your mates and you insult them up to the point that it might just come to fisticuffs or guns. And he was doing the dozens and there was no comeback. And he got everyone, African-Americans in the audience, white people in the audience, rich people in the audience, his likely successor, Hillary Clinton, who wasn't in the audience, but he got her as well. It was a brilliant thing, you know.
Robert, how careful do you need to be when giving a speech like this, though, to maintain the gravitas of the office?
I don't think it's the gravitas. The thing that struck me, and I watched the whole thing, it's an amazing performance. He's actually, although he's a slim and very fit man, I love these really big clowns who move with the grace of a ballerina, Zero Mostel, yeah. Eric Morecambe here. But he was doing the same. He was gliding round, as Michael was saying. The only person who got off the hook, and she took it very graciously, because he said he had nothing to say against it, was Helen Mirren, who was in the audience. But he got the Queen, he got all the others. Yeah, his timing was perfection. Lovely piece in the New York Times today, What It's Like to Write Jokes for President Obama, by David Litt, who has done it for him. It's hell.
I do recommend looking that one up. It's a very funny and illuminating piece. We will have to leave it there. Robert Fox and Michael Goldfarb, thank you for joining us. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Granina. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next at 1900. Rob Bound is in with Culture, and you can hear The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. I think I'm right in saying I'm your host for that as well. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.